everybody, and welcome back to Reading with Rick. And it's the middle of the week again. It's Wednesday, and we've got a couple of stories, and we got a fun one to start tonight. And we're going to go back to the Magic Treehouse with our second book tonight. We'll start telling you what the Magic Treehouse book tonight is. It's called Hour of the Olympics. It says, no girls allowed at the Olympic Games. That's the rule when the Magic Treehouse whisks Jack and Annie back to ancient Greece. But when Annie tells Jack to go to the games without her, he knows she's up to something. Will Annie find a way to see the games, or will she get herself and Jack into Olympic-sized trouble? We'll find out tonight on Hour of the Olympics. The Magic Treehouse, coming up on our second story of the night. But we're going to start tonight, and just a little bit of a story here to get us started here. One of the third grade teachers over at Pioneer Elementary, a good friend of mine, Mrs. Gertz, sent me a book, and it has all kinds of stories in it. And I was looking through it, and there are stories for young kids, so I think you're going to enjoy every one of these stories. But I was looking at it, and it's divided up into all different categories. And, you know, it's kind of like, did your mom ever get one of those boxes of chocolates, and it had all kinds of different kinds of candies in there, and you didn't really know if it was going to be fruity or creamy or have nuts in it or mint or strawberry until you actually bit into it? That's kind of what this book is like. All the different stories are all kind of different. Some are about orphans, children of courage. It says fantasy lands and stories about gigantic creatures and classical tales and animal tales and folk and fairy tales and stories about families and tales from long ago, tales about school and stories that make you think. So we're going to start with a story from the category of, I gotta find it again. Where, what category was that in? I have it placed in my book. It's classic tales. So this is one of the all-time great stories that we're gonna tell you about here tonight. This book is actually, it's compiled in a book titled, Hey, Listen to This, Stories to Read Aloud, written and edited by Jim Treleese. So we're going to read aloud some stories tonight, and the story I've picked out, the classical story tonight, is the story of the Pied Piper. The Pied Piper. Some of you may know this story, and for a lot of you, I bet it's going to be brand new. So let's start with the Pied Piper. Long ago, when kings and queens ruled the great kingdoms, tiny villages of working folks began to spring up beside the rivers that led to the sea. The free-flowing traffic on these rivers turned them into the kingdom's first highways and freeways. Eventually, if the river was deep enough and trade was good, the villages grew from a collection of thatched roof cottages into real towns, with busy docks beside the river, houses and streets of stone, stables and warehouses, even a marketplace and a church. Such a place was, and still is, the German town of Hamelin, nestled comfortably on the banks of the busy Weser River. Each day, the boats and barges pulled into the town's port and unloaded their grain, their lumber, and their trade goods. The marketplace prospered, and so did the people. Smiling down on it all from his office atop the town hall was the Lord Mayor, a blustery man who somehow had come to believe that he was responsible for such success. Into this happy arrangement, there now crept a problem. A brown and black, filthy, four-legged, low-to-the-ground problem. Rats! No one knows exactly why they picked Hamelin, though a good guess might be the dampness of the river and the bulging warehouses, not to mention the garbage that people slop behind their houses. But the rats came. They came by boat, by cart, and by foot. Now, in those days, every town had its share of rats, even the beautiful town of Hamelin. Previously, the town's cats and dogs had kept the population small and timid, afraid to venture out of their holes except at night. Then, almost overnight, the townsfolk found themselves overrun. A plague of rats had descended upon them, great dark creatures that ran boldly in broad daylight through the streets, swarming everywhere so that people were afraid to put their hand or foot down for fear of touching one. When dressing in the morning, they found rats nibbling on forgotten crumbs in coat pockets or chewing on the sweaty salt in their boots. Even worse, when they went to eat, there sat the vermin devouring the last morsel in the house, right in broad daylight. Evenings were even worse. As soon as the lights were out, these untiring nibblers set to work, and everywhere, in the ceilings, in the floors, in the cupboards, behind the walls, there was a chase and scramble, and coupled with the furious sound of sawing teeth and tearing pincers, it made a noise so loud a deaf man could not have rested. They fought the dogs and killed the cats and bit the babies in the cradles and ate the cheeses out of the vats and licked the soup from the cook's own ladles, split open the kegs of salted sprats, made nests inside men's Sunday hats, and even spoiled the women's chats by drowning their speaking with shrieking and squeaking in 50 different sharps and flats. As sleepless night led into sleepless night, the rats took a heavy toll on the humor and patience of the town. Husbands and wives were in constant debate. Parents and children argued endlessly, and the marketplace trembled with the din of shouting and cursing and threatening customers and shopkeepers. Above it all, tucked away in their cushioned chambers, sat the Lord Mayor and his counselors. In the beginning, they had seen the rats as a petty nuisance, and they ignored the problem. As the plague grew beyond ignoring, they promised a solution. But the cats they imported were defeated. The dogs were frightened, the poison proved useless, and the traps sat empty. As the crisis reached a fever pitch, the Lord Mayor announced from his balcony, "At long last, my fellow citizens of Hamelin, I have solved our plague. I promised I would not rest until every rat was gone, and now the end is near. We have hired a rat catcher, renowned for his skill, who will be here tomorrow." You can imagine the cheers that greeted this news. But it was short-lived relief, for the rat catcher made no more of a dent in the problem than did the dogs and cats. Nor did the next rat catcher. In all, 5 rat catchers failed. Like the food in the kitchens and the grain in the warehouses, the town's treasury was sinking lower by the day as more and more coins were spent in pursuit of the rats, and fewer barges stopped at Hamelin. And then one evening, a stranger appeared in the town square, a tall, sandaled fellow, dressed in a long coat that was divided into as many colors as the rainbows. Atop his head sat a narrow felt hat, from which a rooster's scarlet feather protruded. The hat and cloak framed a handsome, hairless face and a pair of piercing yellow eyes. Never had the townsfolk seen such a fellow in Hamelin, and before long a curious crowd gathered around him. "I understand you have a problem with your rats," he said casually to them.
"You can say that again, stranger," someone replied. "Are you another one of the mayor's rat catchers?" another scornfully asked.
"Yes and no," he replied. "I am a rat catcher, among other things, but I do not belong to your mayor. I am my own man."
Strange words from a strange man, thought the crowd. Then the innkeeper stepped forward.
"Sir, if there is anything within your power to ease our plight, we pray you do it. Surely the Lord Mayor would not deny your price after more than 100 days of such torture." A throaty "Amen" went up from the crowd, and within minutes they ushered him into the town hall council chambers.
The mayor, by now, was a desperate man. He loved the comfort of his fine office, to say nothing of its privileges and salary. He knew the people's patience could not hold out much longer. When his efforts failed, he would be dismissed, or worse.
"Kind sir," the mayor began, "if there is indeed anything you could do to ease our plight, we would pay dearly. Name your price, and it will be met."
This was loudly seconded by the citizenry. Several of the counselors, however, were struck by the stranger's odd clothing and piercing eyes.
"How is it, sir," interrupted one, "that you are only now arriving in Hamelin? For months our plague has been the talk of every village and town. A host of rat-catchers have come and gone in these months. What took you so long to come to our aid?"
Silence prevailed. Then a voice came from the back of the crowd.
"Perhaps he's a sorcerer!"
A dry rumble of murmurings greeted that suggestion. Ignoring the question of his identity, the stranger said,
"Lord Mayor, I have been busy these months in Asia and the South, ridding one land of a plague of grasshoppers and the other of vampire bats. Only lately have I learned of your plight."
These words offered renewed hope to the townsfolk, and they again grew restless. So the mayor asked,
"What would be your price, good sir?"
The stranger, who remembered the innkeeper's words in the square, answered, "A gold piece for every day the rats have pained your fair city." The mayor thought to himself, "Who does he think he is? That is three times what any others have asked for. He must be a trickster of some kind. I'll watch this fellow carefully." Nodding wisely, he excused himself for a few minutes in order to confer in private with his council. In his chambers, he pulled the counselors into a corner and whispered, "Sorcerer or not, we've got to do something to keep the people calm. He has no more chance of succeeding than any of the others, but it will at least pacify them for a while." One counselor asked, "But what if he does succeed? His price is more than you or I could earn in a year." The mayor smiled shyly.
"Don't be a fool. Those are the clothes of a gypsy, not a rat catcher. He'll cost us nothing."
When the mayor returned to the townsfolk, he declared,
"We will gladly meet your price, 100 gold pieces,"
and he shook the stranger's hand. The stranger pulled an empty brown leather pouch from his left coat pocket, and he handed it to the mayor. "I want all 100 pieces in here no later than this hour tomorrow, noon." At these words, the mayor's mouth dropped open.
"Surely," he stammered, "your poison cannot work that quickly. By noon you would have not even a dozen alleyways sprinkled."
Glancing out the window at the square scurrying brown creatures, the stranger drew a thin flute from his other coat pocket and replied, "I need no poison as long as I have this." The mayor and his counselor stared in disbelief at the flute, while the townsfolk in the back rows clamored to see what weapon that the stranger had produced. And then the man turned on his heel and strode for the door. "Remember," he called over his shoulder, "noon tomorrow." For the rest of the day, and for the first time in months, the people of Hamelin stopped talking about the rats. The stranger, who quietly disappeared after the meeting in the town hall, became their sole topic, from the oldest to the youngest citizens. They debated whether he was a sorcerer or a madman, miracle worker or a gypsy. And then, as dusk was drawing near, the townsfolk, who had clustered in the marketplace, heard a thin, caressing tune echoing through the alleyways. Families huddled protectively in their kitchens with their few remaining crusts of bread, and they also heard it. Shutters cautiously opened and heads peered out, curiously in search of its origin. And then, one by one, they saw the pied stranger, his flute held gently to his lips, playing his tune. From the balcony of his home, the mayor, along with his wife and daughter, stared at the sight. And just as the tiniest snicker was playing on the mayor's face, another sound was heard above the music, a muffled sound as though an army had muttered. And the muttering grew to a grumbling, and the grumbling grew to a mighty rumbling. And out of the houses the rats came tumbling. Great rats, small rats, lean rats, brawny rats, brown rats, black rats, gray rats, tawny rats, grave old plodders, gay young friskers, fathers, mothers, uncles, cousins, cocking tails and pricking whiskers. Families by tens and dozens, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, followed the piper for their lives. From street to street he piped advancing, and step for step they followed dancing.
from every corner of every cellar and garret, from behind the walls and out of the barrels, from warehouses and wagons, the rats came tripping behind the piper, covering the cobbled streets and marketplace like the waves of a dirty tide. The amazed citizens of Hamelin stared in awed silence from their rooftops, windows, and balconies. They saw the piper stop in the middle of the marketplace, lift his lips from the pipe for a brief second or two, and glance in the direction of the mayor's balcony. Then he lifted the pipe and touched it to the tip of his hat in what looked like a salute, and returned it to his lips and resumed his tune, this time faster and at a higher pitch. With his red, yellow, green, and black cloak flowing behind him in the twilight, he slowly moved through the blanket of rats as his feet moved toward the River Weser. Once, before the plague, it would have been filled with boats. Tonight, it was empty, except for one small rowboat. At the river's edge, the stranger stepped ahead of the rats and into the rowboat. After pushing out of the water, he dropped anchor and picked up his tune again. As unprepared as Hamelin was in for the sights they'd seen so far, in their wildest dreams they could not have imagined what came next. One by one at first, then by the dozen, and finally by the hundreds, the rats moved to the edge of the dock and dropped into the water. While out in the Weser, the piper played his haunting tune. And when the moon finally made its appearance over the very last rat tumbled into the water, swam a few inches, and then sank out of sight with the rest. By now, the people of Hamelin had recovered from their shock, and they were pouring into the square. Husbands cheered and raised their fists in triumph. Wives laughed and wept in relief, and while the church bell pealed, Hamlin's children ran barefoot through the square for the first time in months. So distracted were they in their happiness, and so exhausted from the months of sleepless nights, that no one noticed the absence of the mayor and his counselors at the celebration. The next day, for the first time in months, the morning sun beheld smiling Hamelin face. Upon row of Thanksgiving candles were lit in the church, and the sound of laughter returned to the marketplace. But there was one place empty of laughter, the mayor's office. Slumped in his chair, he was listening to the shrieks of his counselors. "You said he'd never succeed! Trickster, indeed! With the town's coffers almost empty, how do you propose paying the piper? I trust with your own money!" This was greeted with hoots of laughter, which faded quickly with a sudden knock on the door, a knock that coincided with the echo of the noon church bell. The stranger entered the room. The counselors gathered around him, shaking his hand and nervously proclaiming their everlasting gratitude. All of this was suddenly interrupted by the mayor's impatient voice. "If I might interrupt your gaiety for a moment, I believe we have some unfinished business to attend to." The stranger's yellow eyes shifted under his hat. "Unfinished?" he asked. The mayor moved to the window and pointed to the square. "How do we know you have rid us of all the rats? Who's to say there are not hundreds of newborns left in nests and holes throughout the city?" Staring squarely into the eyes of the mayor, the stranger said, "Because I tell you there are not." And he said this so firmly, there was not a man in the room, the world for that matter, who would have argued. So the mayor decided to try another route out of his predicament. "Even so, surely you could not have known when you quoted us the price of 100 pieces of gold that the task would take you only a matter of hours." One of his counselors followed with, "And all for playing a tune!" Another exclaimed, "We'd envisioned your needing weeks to spread the poison in traps." "Why, any of us could have done that had we known the tune," snorted another counselor. The mayor smiled and suggested, "The fairest deal would be a gold piece for every hour it took you to dance the little fellows into the river, which would come to 3. Seeing the stranger's glare intensify, the mayor went on, "But to show how grateful we are, I insist upon tripling that to 9 gold pieces." The piper picked up the empty leather bag from the mayor's desk and held it under his nose. "The bargain was 100 pieces of gold by noon today. We have already wasted too much time. Either you will pay, or your heirs will pay, but the piper must be paid." With those words, the mayor threw out his chest, crossed his arms, and declared, "How dare you threaten us, you strolling vagabond?" He then drew 9 gold pieces from his robe and tossed them onto the desk. "Take it or leave it, and consider yourself well paid." The stranger slowly scanned the faces of the councillors and the mayor. Then he pulled his hat down over his eyes, and a strange smile crossed his face as he walked proudly out of the hall. Behind him, the councillors congratulated the mayor on his determined bargaining. Later that day, when word filtered out to the people of Hamelin, they showed surprisingly little sympathy for the piper. Perhaps the months of suffering had hardened their hearts. Some laughed and suggested the rat catcher was caught in his own trap. But the loudest laughs were saved for the stranger's threat that their children would have to pay the debt. The next day, Sunday, a celebration feast was planned in the marketplace right after church. But it was a celebration that would never be born. For while the adults were crowded into the church, one adult was not among them, the piper. The same one who was at that very moment slowly moving along the narrow streets and alleys, playing a different tune this time. These gentle notes, while not heard by the Hamelin adults in church, were heard by all their children left at home that day. And when the parents finished their church services, they exited into the bright sunshine and found the most astounding sight and sound. There was a rustling that seemed like a bustling of merry crowds jostling at pitching and hustling. Small feet were pattering, wooden shoes clattering, little hands clapping and little tongues chattering. And like fowls in a farmyard when barley is scattering, out came the children running, all the little boys and girls with rosy cheeks and flaxen curls, and sparkling eyes and teeth like pearls. Tripping and skipping ran merrily after the wonderful music with shouting and laughter. The mayor and his wife, all of the council, and every citizen stood stock still in disbelief. The piper's tune had emptied every playroom and nursery. Behind his pied cloak, there now marched a line of laughing, bright-eyed children, holding hands as they trailed through the marketplace toward the river. You might well ask, didn't anybody attempt to stop it? At first, the parents were too stunned to move, and then, just as they came to their senses, the piper moved away from the river and led the dancing throng up Koppelberg Hill. Wait! Shouted the mayor to those parents who had started off in pursuit. He's walked into his own trap. There is no exit from Koppelberg. He'll find a dead end at the mountainside, the fool. And with that, the people breathed a sigh of relief and slowly marched toward Koppelberg Hill so that they could get a better look at the returning children and the embarrassed piper. Only there were no returning children. When the piper reached the mountain, a small opening suddenly appeared in its side. As he coolly played his tune at the entrance, the children, including the mayor's own lovely daughter, gaily skipped through the opening and into the unknown. When the last one disappeared, the piper, without so much as a glance behind, stooped and went inside, and the portal closed behind him. All of this was seen through the astonished tears of the parents at the foot of the hill, too far away to stop it. Within minutes, they arrived at the seamless spot where the children had disappeared. Only dusty footprints remained, ending abruptly at the mountain's solid stone wall. Amid the mother's lamentations, fathers worked through the afternoon and into the evening with pikes and hammers gouging the mountainside until their hands bled. But no sign of the magic door ever appeared. There was never a sadder sight than the broken-hearted line of parents that wove its way home that night under a starless night. Nor was there ever a quieter city than Hamelin. Gone was the scattering scrabble of the rats, but gone, too, was the giggling laughter of children just before sleep, the gentle snoring of little ones tucked into their beds. Only one child, a little lame boy who had not been able to keep up with the others, had not made it to the mountain before the piper sealed the spot. Though his parents' relief knew no bounds, and they never thereafter missed a day thanking the Lord for sparing him, the lad always felt a bitter disappointment. In later years, he used to say, "It's dull in our town since my playmates left. I can't forget that I'm bereft." of all the pleasant sights they see, which the piper also promised me. For he led us, he said, to a joyous land, joining the town and just at hand, where the waters gushed and fruit trees grew and flowers put forth a fairer hue. And everything was strange and new. The sparrows were brighter than peacocks here, and their dogs outran our fallow deer. And honeybees had lost their stings, and horses were born with eagle's wings. And just as I became assured my lame foot would be speedily cured, the music stopped, and I stood still, and found myself outside the hill, left alone against my will, to go now limping as before, and never hear of that country more. Of course, the entire town blamed the mayor. Added to the loss of his daughter were the hateful reproaches his citizens daily heaped upon his soul. But the bitterest part of all was that each of them, from the mayor all the way down to the lowliest goat herder, knew that, but for their own greed and lack of honor, the sound of children's laughter would yet have been heard in the city. Not that the town stood still in its sorrow. The mayor and the councillor sent messengers north, south, east, and west in search of the children. Posters were pasted in every available space, promising the piper every bit of his payment if he would just return their beloved children. Handsome rewards were promised to anyone for even the slightest word of their whereabouts. None came. For evermore in Hamlin, every trade, every family, every inch of ground would be etched with the sorrow of that fateful day. Lawyers dated all their documents, then added below the date, and X years after what happened here on the 22nd of July, 1284. The street that climbed Koppelberg Hill was renamed the Pied Piper Street, and since it was a street of sorrow, no business or trade ever prospered there. And opposite the spot where the children had disappeared, the story was engraved in stone for all posterity to see and learn. They commissioned a stained glass window for the top of St. Nikolai's, a pied figure with flute and children, to remind each of them of their sin. And when visitors came to Hamlin, they often brought their children, until they realized that their children's faces and voices only further reminded Hamlin's parents of the ones they'd never see. Even 50 years later, there was never a visiting child's laughter that did not bring a Hamlin parent rushing to the door or window in hopes of finding the returning children. It was not until more than 150 years later, long after each of those parents was resting in the hereafter, that the first word trickled back to Hamlin. A caravan of merchants passing through the city from the east told of their travels in far-off Hungary. There, in a remote mountainous corner called Transylvania, they found a whole community of people who spoke only German, while all around them in the neighboring cities and towns people spoke Hungarian. After hearing the sad tale today of your long-lost children, we surely think these are their descendants. Of course, it was possible. If music could charm the plague, if mountains could open and close, then anything is possible. And there you have it. That's a great classic story. The Pied Piper. They wouldn't pay the rat catcher, so he took their children. That's kind of scary, but it's a fun story to listen to, wasn't it? So, we are going to send you off to bed, and we'll get ready for our second story. So, we'll come back with The Magic Treehouse and Hour of the Olympics for our second story tonight on Reading with Rick. Thank you.
Are we ready for our second story of the night? I hope so. If those of you that were with us for the Pied Piper in the first part, settle in for another exciting adventure from the Magic Treehouse, the Hour of the Olympics tonight. So let's get started. And we start with a prologue. It's been a little over a week since we went in the Magic Treehouse. We did a lot of the I Survive books last week, so it's good to reacquaint ourselves with Jack and Annie here tonight. So let's get started. One summer day in Frog Creek, Pennsylvania, a mysterious treehouse appeared in the woods. 8-year-old Jack and his 7-year-old sister Annie climbed into the treehouse, and they found it was filled with books. Jack and Annie soon discovered that the treehouse was magic. It could take them to the places in the books. All they had to do was to point to a picture and wish to go there. Along the way, they discovered that the treehouse belongs to Morgan Le Fay. Morgan is a magical librarian from the time of King Arthur. She travels through time and space gathering books. In the magic treehouse, most recently, Jack and Annie saw 4 ancient riddles and became master librarians. To help them in their future tasks, Morgan gave Jack and Annie secret library cards with the letters M.L. on them. Jack and Annie's first 4 missions are to save stories from ancient libraries, and this is their 4th mission. All right. You awake? Annie's voice came out of the dark. Yep, Jack said from his bed. Get up, said Annie. We have to get to the treehouse before sunrise. I'm ready, said Jack. He threw back his covers and jumped out of bed. He was already wearing his jeans and T-shirt. You slept in your clothes? Asked Annie. I didn't want to waste any time, said Jack. He pulled on his backpack, and Annie laughed. You must really be excited about going to ancient Greece, she said. Yep, said Jack. Do you have your secret library card? Asked Annie. Yeah, do you? Said Jack. Sure, put it in your backpack, she said. And she handed her card to him. I'll carry the flashlight. All set, said Jack, and they tiptoed downstairs and out the door. Outside, the air was fresh and cool. There's no moon, said Annie, just stars. She turned on her flashlight. Ta-da, she said, let's go. They followed the beam of light across their yard and up the street. Jack was thrilled to be going to ancient Greece, but something worried him. What do you think will happen after we go to Greece, he asked Annie. Is this our last mission ever? Oh, I hope not, said Annie. What do you think? I don't know, let's ask Morgan, said Jack. Hurry, said Annie, and they started running. The flashlight beam flew in front of them, lighting their way. They slowed to a walk when they got to the Frog Creek woods. The woods were thick and pitch black. Annie shined the flashlight upward as they walked between the trees. Finally, they found the magic treehouse. We're here, Annie called. Go on up, said Jack, and Annie grabbed the rope ladder and started up, and Jack followed. Annie shined the flashlight around the treehouse. Morgan Le Fay was sitting at the window. She covered her eyes when the light hit her face. Turn off the light, please, Annie, she said softly, and Annie turned it off. Welcome, Morgan said in the dark. Are you ready for your next mission? Yes, said Annie. Then her voice got quiet. This isn't our last one ever, is it? Ask me that question after this mission, said Morgan. We want to go on more, said Jack. You're very brave to say that, said Morgan. You've had 3 very hard journeys as master librarians. Oh, they weren't so hard, said Jack. You risked your life to save the lost story of Hercules, said Morgan. It was nothing, said Annie. And the Chinese story of the silk weaver, said Morgan, and the Irish story of the serpent monster Sarf. Thank you. You're welcome, said Jack and Annie. Now, said Morgan, for the last story. And Jack heard a rustling sound. Here is the title, Morgan said. You can shine your light on it, Annie. Annie turned the flashlight back on, and she shined it on the paper, and they could not read what it said. Wow, is that Greek? Asked Jack. It certainly is, said Morgan. She reached into her robe again and pulled out a book. For your research, she said. Jack took the book from her, and Annie shined her flashlight on the cover. They read the title. A Day in Ancient Greece. Now, what must you always remember? Asked Morgan. Our research book will guide us, said Jack. But in our darkest hour, only the lost story can save us, said Annie. Morgan nodded. And you must show your secret library cards to the wisest person you meet, she said. Don't worry, we will. Bye, said Annie. Jack shivered with excitement as he pointed at the book's cover. I wish we could go there, he said. And I wish we could go on lots of other missions, Annie added.
And then the wind began to blow, and the treehouse started to spin, and it spun faster and faster. And then everything was silent. Absolutely silent. Jack opened his eyes. Warm sunshine streamed into the treehouse. "We sure don't need the flashlight here," he said. "Look, Morgan gave us clothes like the ones we wore in Pompeii," said Annie. And Jack looked down. His clothes were similar to the ones he'd worn in the Roman town of Pompeii, a tunic and sandals. He also had a leather bag in place of his backpack again. Annie looked out the window. "And we landed in an olive tree, just like Pompeii," said Annie. Jack looked out the window. He caught his breath. "Are we in the wrong place?" he asked. "I don't know," said Annie. "Look past the trees. Doesn't it look like a big fair?" Jack looked. Annie was right. Past the olive grove was a field filled with white tents. Beyond the field were red brick buildings with columns and huge crowds of people. "What's going on?" Jack asked. He pulled the research book out of his leather bag. He found a picture of the scene outside. Below the picture were these words. "The Olympic Games began in ancient Greece over 2,500 years ago. Every 4 years, more than 40,000 people traveled to Olympia, the town where the festival of athletic games took place." "Oh, man," Jack whispered. "We're at the ancient Olympics." "Cool," said Annie. Jack wrote in his notebook, "Olympia, first Olympics take place." "Come on, let's go watch," Annie said. She started down the rope ladder. Jack threw his notebook and the research book into his leather bag. "Don't forget, we have to get Morgan's story, too," he said as he followed Annie. Annie waited as Jack stepped to the ground. Then they walked through the olive grove to where the tents were. Jack heard pipe music and smelled food roasting over fires. Groups of men talked excitedly to one another. "That's funny," said Annie. "I don't see any girls here." "Oh, sure, they're girls," said Jack. "Where?" said Annie. "Show me." And Jack looked around. But he only saw men and boys. No women or girls at all. Then he saw an outdoor theater. A woman was standing on the stage. She had yellow hair and a purple tunic. "There," said Jack, pointing. "What's she doing?" asked Annie. A soldier was on the stage with her. He wore a long cape. A helmet with a red crest hid his face. The woman and the soldier were waving their arms and talking loudly to each other. "I think they're doing a play," said Jack. "I'll look." He pulled out the Greek book and found a picture of the theater. "Listen," he said, and he read aloud. "The Greeks were the first to write plays. Many English words for the theater came from Greek words such as drama, scenery, and chorus. Many Greek plays are still performed today." "Hey, Jack," said Annie, "you're wrong." When Jack looked up, he saw the woman had pulled off her wig. It was a boy dressed up as a woman. "See, even she's a boy," said Annie. "That's weird." Said Jack, and he went on reading. A few actors would play many different parts in the same play. Women were not allowed to act, so men played the female roles too. "That's not fair," said Annie. "What if a woman wanted to be in a play?" "Don't worry about it," said Jack. He put the book away. "Let's just take a peek at the Olympics, then find our story." He nudged Annie to move along. Just then he heard a voice. "Wait!" They turned around. A man with a short white beard was walking toward them. "Hello," said the man. He was looking right at Annie. "Who are you?" "Who are you?" Annie asked boldly. The bearded man smiled at Annie. "My name is Plato," he said. "Plato," said Jack. That name sounded familiar. "You may have heard of me," the man said. "I'm a philosopher." "What's that mean?" said Annie. "A lover of wisdom," said Plato. "Wow," said Annie, and Plato smiled at her. "It's odd to see a girl walking so bravely through Olympia," he said. "You must be from far away." "We're Jack and Annie," said Annie, "and we come from Frog Creek, Pennsylvania. It's very far away." Plato looked puzzled. Annie turned to Jack. "I think we should show him our cards," she said in a low voice. "He's a lover of wisdom." Jack nodded. He reached into his bag and took out the secret library cards. He showed them to Plato. The letters M and L that stood for Master Librarian glittered on the cards. "Amazing," said Plato. "I've never met such young Master Librarians. Why have you come to Olympia?" Jack pulled out the piece of paper with the title of the story. "We're looking for this story," he said. "Oh, yes," said Plato softly. "This was written by a brilliant poet, a friend of mine, in fact." "Do you know where that poet lives?" asked Jack. "Very near here," said Plato. "Will you take us there?" asked Annie. "Yes, but I must warn you, never tell anyone who the poet is. It's a secret," said Plato. "We won't," whispered Annie. Plato led them away from the outdoor theater. They started down a dirt road. It was crowded with people headed to the games. Plato stopped at the door of a sand-colored house with a brick roof. He opened the door and led Jack and Annie into an empty courtyard. "Wait here," he said, and he disappeared through a doorway. Jack and Annie looked around. Rooms opened onto the sunny courtyard, and everything was quiet. "The people who live here must have gone to the games," said Annie. "I bet you're right," said Jack. He pulled out the Greek book and found a picture of a house, and he read aloud, "Men and women lived in separate parts of a Greek house. Women spent most of their time spinning and weaving and taking care of the kitchen. Boys were sent away to school when they were 7. Girls were not allowed to go to school." "Girls can't go to school?" said Annie. "How do you learn to read and write?" At that moment, Plato returned. With him was a young woman dressed in a long tunic with a colored border. She was holding a scroll. Annie smiled a big smile. "Finally," she said, "another girl." "Jack and Annie, meet our secret poet," said Plato. The young woman smiled at Jack and Annie. "How did you learn to read and write?" Annie asked. "I taught myself," the woman answered. "She wrote a poem and brought it to me," said Plato, "because I have written and told people that I think Greek girls should go to school and learn things." "Is that the poem?" said Jack, and he pointed to the poet's scroll. "Yes," said the young woman. "It's a wonderful story," said Plato, "but she will get in trouble if it's read in our land. You must take it back to your faraway home, where it'll be safe." The poet handed Jack their scroll. He put it into his bag. "Tell us your name," said Annie, "so we can tell people who wrote the story." But the young woman shook her head. "I cannot," she said. When she saw Annie's sad face, she added, "You can tell people it was written by Anonymous." "That's your name?" asked Annie. "No, Anonymous means that no one knows who wrote it," said Plato. "But that's not true," said Annie. "I'm afraid the risk is too great," said Plato. Annie looked back at the woman. "I'm sorry," said Annie. "It's not fair, not at all." The poet smiled at her. "I am happy that you will take my story to your country." Back onto the dirt road. "Girls can't write stories," grumbled Annie. "They can't go to school. They can't be in plays. I have had enough of ancient Greece. Let's get out of here." "Wait," said Jack. "What about the Olympics?" "Oh, yeah," said Annie, and her eyes got brighter. "I almost forgot." "Well," said Plato slowly, "I would like to take you both to the games. I have special seats in the viewing box. However," he looked at Annie. "Don't tell me," she said, "girls can't go to the Olympics either." Plato shook his head. "A girl will get in trouble, terribly, if she goes to the games," he said. Annie sighed. "It's really, really not fair," she said. "I'm sorry," said Plato. "My country is a democracy. We believe in freedom for our citizens, but I'm afraid, right now, that only means men." "Annie's right. It's not fair," said Jack. "I think we should go home now." "No, Jack, you go to the Olympics," said Annie. "At least you can tell me about it. Take notes." "What about you?" Jack said. "I'll go back to that play at the outdoor theater," Annie said. "Meet me there when you're done." Jack didn't want to leave Annie alone, but he also didn't want to miss the Olympics. "Go, have fun," Annie said, and she began walking away. "I'll see you later. Bye, Plato." "Bye, Annie," said Plato. Annie turned back and waved. "I'll tell you all about it," Jack called. "This way," said Plato, and he and Jack turned and joined the crowd, heading toward the Olympic grounds. "This is the very first day of the games," Plato told Jack, "the day of the chariot races." "Oh, wow," whispered Jack. He couldn't believe he was going to see a chariot race. The modern Olympic Games didn't have chariot races. They walked toward the racetrack. Plato pointed to a large building near the road. "That is the gymnasium," he said. "It is where our athletes train. They practice running and throwing the javelin and discus." "We have a gymnasium at our school in Frog Creek," said Jack. "We call it a gym." "People all over the world copy us Greeks," Plato said. "Wait," said Jack. "I have to take notes for Annie." And he pulled out his notebook and wrote, "Ancient Greeks invented gyms."
"Okay, we can go," said Jack, and he tucked his notebook under his arm. As they moved along, Plato pointed to a beautiful tree nearby. "The olive tree is our sacred tree," he said. "The winners of the games will wear crowns made from its branches." "Oh, wow," said Jack, and he wrote, "Olive tree is sacred." Next, they passed a beautiful statue of a winged lady. "Who's that?" said Jack. "She's Nike, the goddess of victory," said Plato, and Jack quickly wrote, "Nike is goddess of victory." "Nike is important to the game," said Plato, "but the most important Olympic god is in there." He took Jack to a brick building with huge columns. They stepped through the door. It was a temple, and Jack gasped. In front of them loomed the biggest statue he'd ever seen. The statue was at least 2 stories high. It was a bearded man sitting on a throne. "This is the Temple of Zeus, and that is a statue of Zeus himself," said Plato. "The Olympic Games are played in his honor. He is the chief god of the Greek gods and goddesses." "Oh, man," whispered Jack. "Yesterday all the athletes came here," said Plato. "They swore to Zeus that they had trained for 10 months, and they promised to obey the rules of the games." The statue of the mighty Greek god stared down at Jack. Jack felt very small. "Hi, Zeus," he said. His voice was small, too. Suddenly, trumpet sounds came from outside. "The hour has come," said Plato. "We must hurry. The Olympic parade begins." Plato and Jack hurried past the crowd standing at the sides of the racetrack. Everyone was shouting and cheering. "I have seats next to the judges," said Plato. He pointed to a tall stand with rows of benches. Plato led Jack through the crowd and up the steps to their seats. "Wow, thanks," said Jack. He had a great view. The Olympic parade had already started. Musicians playing pipes were at the front. Behind them marched the Olympic athletes, the best in all of Greece. Jack sighed as he watched the parade going around the track. Annie would really love this, he thought. "The athletes in front are the runners," said Plato. "Foot races are the oldest event of the Olympics." Jack pulled out his notebook and wrote, "Oldest event is foot races." "Behind the runners are the boxers," said Plato. "They're wearing special gloves and bronze helmets." Jack wrote, "Boxers wear gloves and helmets." "Behind them are the wrestlers," said Plato, and Jack wrote, "Wrestlers." Then Jack looked up again and saw a soldier staring up at him from the sidelines. The soldier was dressed like the actor from the outdoor theater. He had on a long cape and a red-crested helmet that covered most of his face, but something was strange. This soldier was short, really short. "Here come the discus and javelin throwers," said Plato, "and then the men in armor." "What do they do?" asked Jack. "They race wearing full armor," said Plato. Jack smiled to himself. He knew Annie would think that that was funny. He wrote in his notebook, "Some runners race in armor." Jack finished writing. He looked back at the short soldier. "In a moment, the chariot races will begin," said Plato. "Winning a chariot race is the greatest honor of the games." Jack just nodded. He was still studying the short soldier, who seemed to be looking back at him. Suddenly, a small hand came out from the soldier's cape. The hand gave a little wave. Jack gasped. It was Annie's hand waving. The short soldier was Annie. Jack stared in horror at Annie. She must have borrowed a costume from the theater. He remembered Plato's words. A girl will get in terrible trouble if she tries to attend the Olympic Games. Jack shook his head at her and pointed his finger as if to say, "Get out of here!" But Annie just waved at him again. Jack kept shaking his head at Annie. He even shook his fist. Annie turned back to watch the race. "It's not a joke," Jack shouted. Plato turned and looked at him. "Of course not," said Plato. "We take the games very seriously." Jack felt his face grow hot. He glared at Annie's back. Just then, the trumpet sounded. "The chariots are taking their places," said Plato. Jack saw the dozens of chariots lined up on the racetrack. Each chariot was pulled by 4 horses. Jack glanced back at Annie. She was looking up at him, pointing at the chariots. The trumpet sounded again, and the horses took off. The crowd went wild. They were cheering and screaming and stamping their feet. Clouds of dust rose up as the chariots raced around the track. Annie turned back to watch the race. She began jumping up and down. "Go, go, go," she shouted. A few people began staring at the strange small soldier with a high-pitched voice. Jack couldn't take it anymore. He had to get Annie away before it was too late. He shoved his notebook into his bag. "I have to go," he shouted to Plato. The philosopher looked surprised. Jack was afraid to tell him that Annie had broken the rules. "I had a great time, but I have to go home now," said Jack. "Thanks for everything."
"Have a safe journey," said Plato.
Jack waved and started down the steps. As he climbed down, he saw Annie pull off her helmet. Her pigtails flew up and down, and she jumped and shouted, "Go, go, go!" Her soldier's cape fell off. Now lots of people were staring at her. Someone shouted for the guards. Annie was too busy cheering to notice anything. Jack moved as quickly as he could, but two big guards got to Annie first. The guards tried to pull Annie away from the chariot race. Annie looked surprised. Then she looked angry. "Let go of me," she shouted. Jack rushed down the steps of the viewing stand. The guards were having a hard time pulling Annie through all the people. "Leave her alone," Jack yelled. His voice was lost in the noise of the race. He pushed his way through the crowd. "Leave her alone," he kept shouting. "Leave her alone." Finally, Jack reached Annie and the guards. He tried to grab her, but a guard blocked his way. "Let her go," yelled Jack. "I promise. I'll take her home." More guards arrived. The crowd began to shout, "Arrest her! Arrest her!" The guards kept pulling Annie away.
"Jack, the story," cried Annie.
"Of course," thought Jack. "The poet's story. This is definitely our darkest hour." He reached into his bag and pulled out the poet's scroll. He held the story up to the sky. "Save Annie," he shouted. But Jack's voice was again lost in the roar of the race as the four-horse chariots barreled through the dust. Jack looked around wildly for someone or something to help them. Then, suddenly, the crowd fell silent. All heads turned to watch as a huge white horse galloped out of the dust. The crowd murmured with excitement and wonder. The white horse was the most beautiful animal Jack had ever seen. He was pulling an empty chariot, and he was galloping straight toward Jack. The white horse stopped at the low wall by the edge of the track.
"He's come for us," cried Annie.
The guards stared in awe at the horse. Annie broke free and dashed over to Jack, and he grabbed her hand and they ran to the horse. The guards shouted and started after them, but they were too late. Jack and Annie had already climbed over the wall and into the waiting chariot.
"Go, go, go," Annie cried to the huge white horse, and the horse reared and pawed the air.
The crowd stepped back from the wall and the guards froze. Jack looked up to where Plato was now standing. Plato smiled and waved at him. Then the white horse leaped forward, pulling the chariot behind him. Jack couldn't even wave back at Plato. All he could do was hold on tight as the horse galloped beside the Olympic racers. Jack bounced up and down. Dust and sand got in his eyes. He squeezed them shut and crouched down in the chariot. He didn't know where they were going, but it didn't matter. The white horse was in charge. Jack heard the thundering noise of the racing horses and chariots. He heard the screaming crowd. He felt sand blowing in his face and the hard bumping and rattling of the chariot. Suddenly, he was thrown backward. He heard a swoosh of wind and then silence.
"Oh, wow," cried Annie.
And Jack opened his eyes. All he saw was blue sky. He pushed his glasses into place and looked around.
"Help!" he cried.
The white horse had grown giant feathery wings and was pulling their chariot into the sky. Jack gripped the railing of the chariot and held on for his life.
"To the treehouse!" shouted Annie.
Below, the Olympic crowd watched in stunned silence. The winged horse left the games behind and flew over the Temple of Zeus, over the statue of Nike, over the sacred olive tree and the gymnasium. On they went, over the poet's house, the Greek theater, and the field of white tents. And finally, the winged horse coasted to the ground near the olive grove. The wheels of the chariot bumped onto the grass. Then slowly, slowly, they came to a stop. Jack and Annie stepped out of the chariot. Jack's legs were so wobbly he could barely walk. Annie rushed to the horse and stroked his neck.
"Thank you," she whispered.
Jack patted the horse's long white neck, too. "Thanks," he said. "That was the best ride of my life." The horse snorted and pawed the ground.
"Come on, Annie. We have to go before they find us," said Jack.
"I don't want to leave him," said Annie. "He's the most beautiful horse in the whole world." Her eyes filled with tears.
"We have to," said Jack.
The horse put his head down and touched Annie's forehead with his soft nose. Then he gave her a gentle push toward the treehouse. Annie sniffled, but started walking. Jack took her hand as they walked through the olive grove to the rope ladder of the treehouse. "You first," Jack said. Annie started up the ladder, and Jack followed. When they were inside, Annie hurried to the window. Jack grabbed the Pennsylvania book. He pointed to a picture of the Frog Creek woods and said, "I wish..." "Look," said Annie. Jack looked out the window. The horse had spread his great feathery wings. He was rising from the field. The white horse flew high into the blue Olympian sky. Then he disappeared behind the clouds. "Bye," called Annie, and a tear rolled down her cheek. Jack pointed again at the Pennsylvania book. "I wish we could go there," he said. And the wind started to blow, and the treehouse began to spin, and it spun faster and faster. And then everything was still, absolutely still. Jack opened his eyes. It was so dark, he couldn't see anything. He felt his clothes. He was wearing his T-shirt and jeans again. The leather bag had turned back into his backpack. "Hello," said Morgan Le Fay. Her voice came from the corner of the treehouse. "Hi," said Annie. "Did you have a good journey?" asked Morgan. "I did," said Jack, "but girls can't do anything fun in ancient Greece." "I did one fun thing," Annie said wistfully. "I rode in a chariot pulled by a flying horse." "That must have been wonderful," said Morgan. "You were very lucky to be bringing me the story of Pegasus."
"Who?" said Jack.
"Pegasus," said Morgan. "He's the great white-winged horse in Greek mythology."
"Oh, yeah," said Jack. "I think I've heard of him."
He felt in his backpack and found the scroll. He gave it to Morgan. He could still barely see her in the dark.
"It was written by Anonymous," said Annie.
"I know," said Morgan. "Many talented women used that name in the past. Her story will be a great addition to my Camelot library."
"Plato helped us find it," said Jack.
"Ah, my good friend Plato," said Morgan. "He was one of the greatest thinkers who ever lived."
"And Pegasus was the greatest horse," said Annie.
She sighed. "I just wish I could see him again."
"You can," Morgan said softly. "He's here right now."
"Pegasus!" cried Annie. "Oh, boy!"
Annie turned on the flashlight and used it to find her way down the rope ladder. Jack grabbed his backpack and followed her. When they were both standing on the ground, Annie shined her flashlight at the dark trees.
"Pegasus!" she said. "Where are you? Pegasus!"
"Turn off your flashlight, Annie," said Morgan. She was looking down from the treehouse window. Annie switched off the light. "In the night, you can see all the story characters that saved you on your last four missions," said Morgan. "They are all here. Hercules and the Silk Weaver, Sarf the Serpent Monster, and Pegasus." Jack pushed his glasses into place and studied the dark woods.
"Where are they, Morgan?" cried Annie. "Where's Pegasus?"
"Look hard," said Morgan.
"I can't see him," said Annie.
"Yes, you can," said Morgan. "The old stories are always with us. We are never alone."
"Has Morgan gone crazy?" wondered Jack.
"Look up," said Morgan. "Your friends are in the night sky. They are stars."
"Stars?" whispered Jack.
He stared at the shimmering field of tiny stars overhead.
"Hercules is a constellation," said Morgan.
"The Romans imagined him kneeling in the sky, holding a club over his head." Morgan waved her finger at the sky. For a moment, Jack saw a living, breathing Hercules outlined by stars.
"And there's the Silk Weaver with her beloved cowherd," said Morgan. "The ancient Chinese believed that they were two stars on either side of the Milky Way."
Morgan waved her hand again. The lovely Silk Weaver was outlined in the heavens. "And long ago, the Irish believed the Milky Way itself was the serpent monster Sarf," said Morgan. And Morgan waved her hand. A giant serpent glittered through the sky.
"And the ancient Greeks named one of their constellations Pegasus," said Morgan.
She waved her hand again, and the white horse's head, wings, and galloping legs glowed in the sky.
"I see him," said Annie. Then she whispered, "I love you, Pegasus."
Jack thought he saw the stars move as if Pegasus was rearing back in the sky. After a breathless moment of silence, Morgan lowered her arm. The night sky became a field of tiny glittering stars again.
"You have done amazing work as master librarian," said Morgan. "I would trust you with any important mission." Does that mean we're going on more trips? Asked Jack.
Indeed it does, said Morgan. Many more.
Jack smiled with relief.
When's our next mission? Asked Annie.
As soon as I need your help.
I'll send for you, said Morgan. Go home now and rest.
Goodbye, said Annie.
Goodbye, said Jack.
Farewell, said Morgan.
And there was a sudden rushing of wind, then a blur of blinding light, and Morgan Le Fay and the magic treehouse vanished. The night was still.
Home? Asked Annie.
Sure, said Jack.
As they walked between the trees, the Frog Creek woods were pitch black. Jack couldn't see a thing, but he didn't ask Annie to turn on the flashlight. For once, he wasn't worried about finding his way home. He felt as if someone or something was leading them through the woods. Morgan's words came back to him. The old stories are always with us. You are never alone.
Jack looked up at the stars again.
They were beginning to fade in the growing light of dawn, but he thought he could hear the beating of giant wings somewhere high above.
And that's it for tonight. The Magic Treehouse Hour of the Olympics and the Pied Piper. What a fun night of two good stories that was. I hope you can come back again tomorrow night, and we're going to have another fun story from that book that Mrs. Gertz lent to me, and I'll find a good one for you. The Pied Piper was really good, but this book is just full of good stories, so we're going to come back with that again tomorrow. So you have yourself a good night and a better day tomorrow. And we'll talk to you when Reading with Rick comes back tomorrow night. Good night, everybody.